Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The Inner Game is about how we nurture and attend to our mind, body, spirit health, and how that allows us to make a bigger contribution in the area of purpose that calls to us. Because these are times that are asking us to evolve beyond the systems and paradigms that are collapsing. And these are conversations with people who are committed to making an evolutionary difference with their lives from a place of balance and love and service. Today, I'm joined by Adrian Howell, who is a photographer, storyteller, filmmaker, and athlete. He's currently working with Tucker Ferris on a documentary about the activism that has protected the Thompson Divide, a precious piece of land and water above Carbondale, Colorado, and protecting it from oil and gas development. Welcome, Adrian.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear a little bit about what it has been like for you to be in your generation, growing up during a time when the climate crisis has been something you've grown up with.
Yeah, it's a big question, and I think it deserves a big answer. But I would say, to start with, it's complicated, and I think unique, like every experience for every generation is. I think we have a very different experience because of this intersection between a more analog and a more digital world. So we kind of knew what it was like before smartphones and technology and social media, and we also know what it's like after that. And I have a very unique perspective of being able to experience both of those. And because of that, I also get to see the positives and the negatives from how that affects us. And I think also in terms of awareness around topics like climate change or environmental degradation or any kind of social, cultural, environmental issue, it's easier than ever to access this information, but it's also, I think, easy to be overwhelmed by it. Yeah. Also because of how this information is distributed, it's done in a way that the most, let's say, negative and disaster-oriented topics are the ones that are the most prevailing.
And you grew up with social media.
Exactly.
So you've always had that kind of like the water you swim in, you know, this information all around you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's a strange one as well, because also social media is also very much tied into people's identities. You know, so you look for people that affirm your beliefs, and you might easily get stuck in echo chambers where you're kind of only, well, as the name implies, you're only surrounded by people who are kind of reverberating the same beliefs that you have, which I think is a big issue. And I realized the importance of stepping outside of that and being able to just have conversations with people, especially people that really I disagree with on many things, and trying to find that sense of common humanity. And I think that's a really important thing that a lot of people in my generation are kind of lacking in terms of their willingness to talk to people that they disagree with. And I think it's worth stepping away from the phones and the echo chambers to just sit down with people, and especially ones who have polarizing opinions, and realize actually, yeah, we share more in common than we have different.
Right.
And actually that's a really, really positive and inspiring thing, because in the end, actually, everyone wants to have a good life. No one wants to be, let's say, dreading the future. Right. And we have to find collaboratively ways of fulfilling that beyond just kind of shouting and fighting with each other.
You made a lifestyle choice when you were 16.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when I was 16, I decided to go vegetarian, and then shortly after that, vegan. And my perspective has changed a lot since then. I mean, it was 10 years ago, or 11 years ago now. And I think the most critical aspect of this lifestyle change was the willingness to not want to hide anymore, to want to just actually see things as they are, to be willing to, let's say, face uncomfortable truths about the way that I was living, about the ways that we're living. And I would say that act was less about making a decision about what I'm ingesting and in terms of food, but also in terms of what I'm ingesting in every sense, you know, in terms of information, in terms of the people I'm surrounded by, in terms of also questioning the things that in the past we've been kind of conditioned by. And And I think we're not taught to do that. So it was quite an eye-opener.
As a fellow athlete, I wanted to talk a little bit about the spiritual aspects of what we do. Like, for a number of years now, I've committed to spend a part of every day in the mountains. And depending on the season, it could be hiking, paddling rivers, inline skating on mountain roads, or in the winter, all the different kinds of skiing. Part of this, you know, is definitely to keep my body strong, but the bigger piece is spending time in the places that heal my soul and deepening my relationship with them. It's a time I often spend in prayer, which helps me keep showing up fully for the outer service that I do. And I recently heard something, it was actually just this morning, I heard something about Stan Rushworth, who's a Native American professor of literature in Northern California. And he shares that the most important thing we can do for the sake of the planet is to be so still in our beings that we hear the voice of Mismisa, the spirit of the mountains, that guides us onto the correct course in our lives. And I just wanted you to reflect on that, because I know you spend big chunks of time in nature as an athlete outdoors.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, I think it's an aspect to being an athlete that is greatly underemphasized, and even actually just not even explored by most people who undertake athletic endeavors. I mean, you can't compare, for example, road running with trail running, or road cycling with mountain biking, and you see this in the people that are attracted to those sports. And I'm allowed to say that also because I was a road cyclist. I got into riding bikes through mountain biking, and well, where I lived in the UK, there was not really much possibility for mountain biking. So this kind of athletic journey, I would say, was a kind of process of actually going back into the wild places, even if they're very small, and through that, finding this place of stillness and solitude and introspection that is very difficult to come by nowadays. And I think also something that isn't at all really discussed within athletic culture. And so I, as much as I kind of got into it and I was attracted by the idea of improving and, you know, getting better times and also at some point competing, I think there's a huge element where people get too stuck on that and they lose this kind of deeper aspect that you can actually really discover and benefit from so much more through being in nature, through being in the quietness, through just having time with yourself. And unfortunately, I think it's a shame that people don't really get to do that, or they, at least they don't allow themselves to do that. And I think there's an interesting dichotomy between athleticism as escapism and also as a kind of ego kind of amplification, and the opposite, which I guess is more kind of ego dissolution. And I think that's the reason that I do it, and that's also the reason I don't compete anymore, because it kind of puts me into a mindset which I don't really align with. And well, not just a mindset, but also just a way of being. And if I go out every day and I know, well, I don't have a goal, but I'm just gonna get out, I'm gonna do it because I like how it feels, I like how how I experience the elements and the seasons throughout the year. I like to kind of look at a map and think, okay, I've not been over there yet, this looks really interesting. Or even, you know, especially with running, just look at a mountain on a map and think, okay, there's actually not a trail here, but there's a ridge, maybe I can just climb it. and then really just going up on all fours, you know, coming back scratched to pieces, maybe even bleeding from, you know, going through the scrub. And it's a completely different way of experiencing athleticism and the outdoors, and I hope that people can discover that more. At least that's what I would try and do in terms of what I share, is to share more of this aspect.
Do you find that course correction happening, or that guidance from, you know, feelings and information you get from the land while you're out there?
Definitely. Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's extremely difficult to articulate it, but it's, I think, through having this combined element of being completely exposed to the elements and to nature's forces, plus let's say like this kind of surrendering that you have to do through passing through your mental noise and getting into a rhythm, and you know, you're just breathing and moving and it's very primal. Yeah, it does kind of open you up to different ways of perceiving reality. Especially if you're climbing a mountain, I mean, you can have this very you know, visceral and literal experience where you're at the top of the mountain and you're looking where you came back down, and it's like you're a complete different person. And the only hope that I can have is by the time I get down to the bottom, I can bring a little bit of what I found at the top back with me. Yeah. Or at least every time I do it, I can bring a little bit more.
Yeah.
Even though it's obviously very easy once you get back down to fall back into the noise of daily living.
Yeah.
But that's what I would intend to do.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like having it as a practice.
Definitely.
Helps
it's completely
that.
Different. If you yeah. say something is a practice, it's completely different. It's training and a practice.
Right.
Completely different.
Yeah.
You know, and it's extremely important, I think, to define the differences between these two terms, because mm-hmm. in the end they describe what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
but they're describing differently how you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, how you're intending on doing it. And it's like black or white, as far as I'm concerned.
Since I've perceived my time out there in the wild as prayer, it has transformed the richness of the experience and the devotion that I bring to it, you know, and the commitment
mm-hmm.
that I bring to it. And yeah, I think that how you perceive or how you label the practice is really super important. Thanks for that.
Definitely.
So let's talk about the Thompson Divide.
Yeah, cool.
You got connected to Carbondale local Tucker Ferris through social media,
mm-hmm.
as you do.
Yes, it's these days.
What was it that inspired you to get involved in telling the story?
So I, on a personal level, reached a point this year where I was feeling a bit frustrated creatively, like my kind of creative work had just become work. Mm-hmm. And so again, talking about this importance between words, you know, work or practice, where you could say creative work, creative practice, they're very different things, you know. And so I got to a point where I thought, oh, okay, I got into this for one reason, and where I'm at is a whole different thing, you know. And perhaps that's a commercial element, but I think in a deeper aspect of who I am, there's a purity to documentary storytelling, which you don't get if you're doing a project which ultimately is selling product. And because, you know, Tucker is local here, and I've wanted to visit for a very long time, and you know, the landscape in Colorado is just really mesmerizing. I thought, yeah, I'm a mountain person. We were just talking, and I told him a bit about my situation, and I have no idea how it came up, but he mentioned, oh, you know, there's this topic of the Thompson Divide, you know, this wilderness area that was being illegally sold off for leases for oil and gas. And I was just immediately interested, because I also have in the past found a lot of interest in these types of stories where people are using their creative practice as a means of facilitating positive change. You know, that could be social, it could be cultural, it could be environmental. And honestly, that was about as much as we worked with. I was just like, I'm going to book my flight. I'm going to go for 2 weeks and just show up. And, you know, with this intention of wanting to tell a meaningful story. And that's how it happened.
So let's take a quick break. I just wanted to let people know this is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KDNK. I'm talking with Adrian Howell about telling stories of climate action and the bigger story of our interbeing with the land and water and animals that make our existence possible. So in the process of figuring out how to tell this story, you realize there's a bigger story to be told. Can you start to articulate that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. I think with storytelling in general, especially with documentary, you realize there are many elements that connect to each other. And I think this is true for anything. You know, we like to view everything that we see as some individual piece, and actually it is a piece that is connected to a much larger whole. And so kind of unraveling this thread of the Thompson Divide, it was pretty clear actually you can't really understand this issue of, let's say, conservation and development or extraction versus recreation without understanding what is the wider context. And so, you know, that could be just looking at a map and thinking, wow, it's kind of a complete illusion that someone just said, this thing that I've just drawn a boundary is a divide. It's the Thompson Divide, named after some guy who came here, who wasn't the first guy to come here, who just says, for some reason, this, and it's not even a square, it's a very random shape. And when I looked at it, I thought, wow, this is so interesting, because it really reflects the way that we view reality. We view it in these compartmentalized pieces where things are labeled and, you know, dissected into different pieces.
Especially nature.
Exactly, especially nature. And purely also from a level of, well, what commercial value does this have? You know, how can we extract resources? How can we even conserve it for recreational value? You know, and so this is really the interesting element. It's actually understanding culturally why it is that we view things in certain ways. And what I find especially fascinating about America, North America, is it wasn't that long ago that obviously the entire continent was indigenous. And this is a very stark contrast to Europe, which, as you realize, when the settlers come and start colonizing, there are very contrasting opinions, let's say, to put it lightly, in terms of how we view our relationship to the land. And it's impossible to look at the mess that we're in currently in terms of climate, in terms of environment, and also social political issues without looking at, well, there were a group of people that were living here previously for thousands of years who were doing a pretty good job of being stewards of the land, of understanding their place within the wider ecosystem, with really not being greedy. And yeah. Something happened when people came,
yeah,
where actually Colorado, the first glimpses, as we understand through doing the research for this documentary, people were looking at it thinking, how can I take gold? How can I take silver? Right. How can I take coal? How can I take something to make my life better? And, well, everyone wants to have a better life, and that's not a bad thing, but it's at the loss of something else.
Right.
And it's not just something else. It's the thing that is enabling us to live. Right. You know, it's our air, our water, our soil. Yeah. And this is a very bizarre concept. And so, as much as I understand the desire and the need for conservation, the question is, why do we need to conserve anyway? And what I found especially interesting is going back into the history with John Muir, for example, and Roosevelt, and how they, you know, more or less initiated the process of establishing national parks and these conservation areas. It was through this idea of saying, well, you know, we're destroying all of this. We just have to, you know, put a fence around this nice part and conserve it because it's good for hunting, it's good for fishing. Well,
we'll destroy everything around the edges of it.
And then when that's gone, then we'll just eventually kind of tap in. You know, that is the issue that we're facing. You know, so in conservation, as I see it, it was just a means of pushing back a completely unsustainable, degenerative culture that is causing a complete mess in every sense.
Right.
And it is a colonial perspective, this idea to conserve.
That is so interesting, Adrian. I've never actually considered how even conservation still is part of the predominant paradigm of colonialism and destruction and overuse and all of that.
Yeah. And this is the thing. It's like pulling on a thread that just keeps unraveling.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you realize, well, actually, yeah, it's our language, our culture, our conditioning, our history that we have to step outside of completely. And really the amazing thing is, yeah, because this history in North America is a relatively recent thing, you can say, well, what is it in the philosophy, in the lifestyle, in the perspective that the indigenous people had here that is missing from our way of being? You know, not how can we appropriate that into, you know, how can we copy their practices, but how can we look at what we're doing critically and think, what is missing to enable us to create a future for future generations that isn't going to just leave them a bunch of mess?
Yeah.
And there is something there that needs to be learned. And I can't say I have the answer yet, but I'm very interested to discover that.
Yeah. And I see that because it's interesting. We met because Rita Marsh of the Center for Human Flourishing and I have been on a learning journey for almost 2 years now with an international group of people and organizations interested in organizing and serving bioregional regeneration. So this whole idea of bioregionalism, which is looking at how to approach regenerating our degraded ecosystems at landscape scales. So looking at entire watersheds and land areas defined with natural borders and creating the social structures to serve those areas. So it's really that deeper piece that we're talking about of really changing this paradigm of how we relate to the land.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to operate in a way that allows for the flourishing of all life?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the question you're starting to ask.
Yeah, and it's exactly the same path that I also found myself on. You know, I was interested firstly in regenerative agriculture because I think it's a very direct means of changing our relationship to the land through a practical means, specifically in the face of an industry which is completely broken. You know, farmers are struggling severely. You know, I think the suicide rate for farmers is astronomically high. And well, I don't think it's coincidental. It's because we're basically forcing other humans and ourselves to live in a way where we're only commodifying the land and we're not thinking, well, this land also has ecological value. This land, the soil needs to be regenerated. We can't just keep, you know, churning it over and dumping industrial pesticides and fertilizers on it and expecting that it's going to keep producing. It doesn't work like this. So I think it's a very interesting entry point, and I think a very practical one, and also a very complicated one. But yeah, that discovery of regenerative agriculture led me on to this more kind of broader systems thinking aspect of bioregional regeneration and what that would look like, and also the obstacles that are in our way, yeah. Which I think is a very overwhelming thing, but also mm-hmm. a very important thing, because in the end, we are all stuck in ways of being that have been predefined, and for some reason we've all just signed up to it instead of being like, well, yeah. What are we doing?
And that's why I do this show, because yeah. I like looking at what is it that allows us to evolve our worldview, evolve our way of being as humans in this moment. And I always like to ask my guests about a growth edge that you're currently working on in your life, you know, and sort of how that is helping you to expand and grow and evolve.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think it's, I would say, the most pressing issue that most people I know face, and maybe most people in general face, is the financial one. Mm. And it's not something that sounds very, you know, the perception of finances in general has been very badly represented by very greedy people and corporations. And as long as we're living within the system, we need to find means of still facilitating things to happen through financial means. And so this is the thing that I'm working on, is doing that in a way without compromising on integrity, without needing to sell shit that I don't believe in, without, basically just trying to find means of facilitating positive change with the projects that I'm working on. And it requires finances, you know? Yeah. So I think this is a really interesting topic that we all get to explore. Because I think in the end, the financial institutions that run our world are a great example of these structures that we haven't questioned enough, and why the banking system works the way that it does, mm-hmm. why we have economic policies that work in the way that they do. So this is a very interesting one. And honestly, I've put it off for such a long time because I had so many preconceived ideas and judgments around finances, you know. And so I think it's very true for a lot of people who feel they become kind of cynical because of the way people act around money and because of the greed and the negative implications that greed can have. But these things exist beyond that, and whether money existed or not, I think people that do have greedy qualities or unhealthy personality traits, they'll just find another means of doing that. And so it's important to separate that from also our current need to find ways to make things work financially and do it in a way that we're not kind of compromising on our values.
I learned how to be a fundraiser because I worked in nonprofits for a long time from a gal named Lynn Twist, who kind of spearheaded the whole idea of sufficiency. And that feels like a really important thing for us all to look at. Like, what is enough? You know, what's enough to make a flourishing life? And it's that piece of, you know, beyond that is greed, maybe fueled by fear or the need for some kind of illusory security. I think we have this huge need for security. And And I'm kind of thinking that's a big piece of this as you're talking about that.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's a really important one because the scales have been tipped just too dramatically, you know, yeah. And I think it's important to look at what not only we need financially, but also in every sense. And I think a lot of people are trying to compensate financially and materially for what they're lacking.
Yes.
I hesitate to use the word spiritually because I think yeah. it can be, you know, misinterpreted, but the non-physical qualities yes. that we need as humans,
yeah.
most people are lacking, and you can't be a billionaire to try and you can't buy into it, you know.
Well, this has been awesome. Thank you very, very much for this. I've really had some ahas, and I wonder how people can connect with you and follow your work.
Yeah, so if you're a younger person such as myself, Instagram seems to be the the means of doing so. So my name, Adrian Howell, AdrianHowell. It's that with two H's. Website is the same. And yeah.
Substack as well,
yeah. Under the same name, exactly. Great. And hopefully the film is called Bridging the Divide. Hopefully when that is done, we're going to have some traction around this and a whole new movement and means of storytelling will be created from this.
Beautiful. Thank you for listening today. If you have a question for Adrian or me, please join the Facebook page at The Inner Game. We'd love to hear your feedback and ideas. You can listen to shows on Apple Podcasts as well. Thank you to Peter Mayer for his music. And we'll see you next time.
Clouds are swift, rocks are ancient, mountains are high.